Tut-tut, and I'm sure you know the rest of that. Who needs enemies? It is a section in which we're going to learn more about the disciples, and it's a very different part of the book. It begins a new emphasis, which we have not seen in the first 2 days. We are starting at chapter 6, verse 30, and I would suggest that we think about it now in terms of Jesus concentrating on his disciples. You'll notice that, you remember maybe yesterday, Jesus had sent out the 12 to preach and cast out demons, and then, as was typical with Mark, there is a sort of a meanwhile story, the story of Herod and the execution of John the Baptist. Now with 6:30, we pick up the return of the apostles who meet with Jesus and tell him all that they had done and taught. And from this point on, Jesus begins to teach and work with these disciples in a very intensive way. We hear the crowds are there, but the crowds are kind of the setting now for the interchange between Jesus and his disciples. And that's what we're going to be concentrating on today. It's a fairly long section, and I'm going to do it this way. I'm going to first give you a kind of summary or a structural picture of what's happening in chapters 6, 7, and 8. It's an interesting thing that happens there. Then we're going to look at the ridgepole of Mark, the climax, Peter's confession about the identity of Jesus. And then the second half of the time, we'll be spending more on discussion of the teachings that then occur immediately after Jesus' identity is recognized by Peter. Now, the first thing one notices, if you read through sections chapters 6, 7, and 8, is that there is a kind of double account of the feeding of 5,000, or the feeding of thousands of people. Mark describes the story in familiar ways that you'll find right there in 6:33 and following. And then back in chapter 8, at the beginning of chapter 8, there is a very similar account, in fact, verbally identical, except there it is 4,000 people instead of 5,000. Well, what's going on? Well, some people say, well, it was just the same event. You had different people counting. You know how that goes. You have a lot of people there. We have in Decorah a Nordic Fest every summer, big town celebration. And the big question after Nordic Fest every year is how many people were at Nordic Fest? Well, you've got people driving in and out of town and wandering around. So people say, oh, there must have been 20,000 this year. Somebody says, oh, no, we had 20,000 3 years ago. There were more here this year. It must have been 50,000. Oh, no, well, I think it was about 40. Well, then the word will get out. Well, it's 40,000. And everybody will think, well, it's 40,000 people. Well, how do you know? You never do. So were they counting? Did they have ushers clicking people off as they came in? Or they seated them in groups? So maybe they had, okay, 100 per group, and we'll see. We got 40 groups or 50 groups, you know. How do they do it? We don't know that. So the implication often is, well, this is simply two versions of the same event. It may well have been, but it's interesting that Mark puts them both in, and he does more than that. He builds a parallel structure from these two. I'm calling this section, hope you can read it back there, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Preparing the disciples, because now we're concentrating on the disciples, and he begins by feeding thousands of people, and this will set the theme for this whole section. It's not just an isolated story, because the theme of bread and feeding will recur again and again. Now, he does that 6:33 to 44. That's right where we are now. But then it occurs again, the feeding of the 4,000, it is sometimes called, in 8, 1 to 9. In each case, following the feeding, there is an account of crossing the lake. In chapter 6, it's a fairly extended account, 45 to 56, in which Jesus walks past them in the boat as they are crossing the lake in the middle of the night, between 3 and 6 in the morning. crosses the lake, and they frightened see him, and then he comes into the boat with them and comforts them. The presence of Jesus comforts them. In chapter 8, it's just a very brief account of their getting across the lake. But then following the crossing of the lake, there is a section in which there's a confrontation. 7:1-23, the confrontations with the Pharisees in both cases. Here, a rather long one, in which the same issues come up that came up back earlier when Jesus was arguing with the Pharisees. Remember, there was the question of the Sabbath, the question of his disciples not eating the right foods, they didn't fast, and the question of his welcoming the tax collector Levi. Here, we have the same kind of three things. There is a ritual question about washing hands. Disciples aren't washing their hands, which was a new rule in Judaism at the time. Secondly, there is the question of korban. This is the question of the duty one had to one's parents. It was an issue of a commandment, like the commandment against desecrating the Sabbath. And then there's again the question of eating unclean foods, just like in earlier chapter, it was a question of inviting in unclean people. So the struggle of the Pharisees continues. It's the same song, second verse, a little bit louder, a little bit worse. In chapter 8, verses 11 to 13, it's very brief. There's a confrontation that the Pharisees there want a sign from heaven. Now, what's a sign from heaven? He's been performing miracles right and left. What do they want? Well, it's like you have a 3-foot, you have an 8-foot sailboat, you want to get a 12-foot sailboat. You have a 12-foot sailboat, you say, well, if I only had an 18-foot sailboat, 18-foot sailboat, well, a 23-foot would be just right. And then you need one of the radio and navigation lanes, and so it goes. It's just like with miracles. You get one, you say, well, if it was a little bigger, then I'd be sure you were really the Christ. So a sign from heaven can be interpreted as a kind of maximal miracle, something that would be clearly from heaven and demonstrate once and for all Jesus' identity. The Pharisees are still asking the identity question. Now, in both sections again, there is then a reference, following this controversy, a reference to bread. In chapter 7, Jesus goes into the country of the Syrophoenicians. That's up northwest of Galilee. And there's this famous story of a woman whose daughter is possessed of a demon. She asks Jesus to heal the daughter, cast out the demon, and Jesus says he's sent to the house of Israel, and she makes that statement about, well, the crumbs from the table at least can be given to the dogs. And he says, your faith is great, and heals the child. So it's the children's bread, I'm calling it here, because again, the emphasis is on, it is not right to give the children's bread to the dogs. Well, she said, at least we get the crumbs. It's the story of faith of someone outside Israel. Now, in the other parallel, in chapter 8, this has gotten right since 8:14-21, Jesus warns them of the leaven of the Pharisees, or the yeast of the Pharisees, and the yeast of Herod. Now remember, we had just heard about Herod at the beginning of chapter 6. And now Herod becomes one of those who are in league against Jesus. Jesus mentions the leaven of both of them, yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod. And the disciples, of course, totally misunderstand what it's about. We'll look at their misunderstandings in a few minutes. And Jesus gets pretty impatient with them. And both sections then, both chapters 6 through 7 and chapter 8, end with a healing. And if you look at them this way, it's interesting that the first healing is the healing of a deaf mute, and the second is the healing of a blind man. There are a couple of healings of blind people in Mark, and we meet one here. Now, if we just look at that section quickly, we see it starts with a symbol of the power of Jesus to disciples who feel they do not have adequate resources. The question in both cases, what is so little among so many? we don't have enough bread to feed this crowd. Think of the early church, think of the early disciples, the problem of adequacy. Jesus' miracle, which is given twice, is that indeed he can make their little enough. In fact, there's more than enough. In one case, it's 12 baskets of fragments, in the other, it's 7 left over. Then Jesus assures the disciples in the crossing of the lake. Jesus is present with them. Then there is this conflict section. Then a section which talks again about bread, this time to the Gentiles, and watch out for the leaven, the yeast of the Pharisees. And then an ending where there are two levels of opening, one of ears and tongue, and the other of eyes. Now, what are the disciples doing through all this? Well, let's just kind of go quickly. Verse 52 of chapter 6 is the first effort to try to describe how the disciples are dealing with all of these amazing things. 6:52, about 51. They are completely amazed because they have not understood the real meaning of the teaching of the feeding of the 5,000. Their minds could not grasp it. Disciples are having the same problem with Jesus' miracles that the public had with Jesus' parables. They do not understand. Okay? Then one can look at 7:17-18. Jesus has had an argument now with the Pharisees, and after teaching in front of the crowd, they go into a house, and his disciples say, come on now, what in the world was that all about? And Jesus says, well, you're not any brighter than the others. Don't you understand? And then he makes the statement about cleanliness, and then goes on to explain it in 20, 21, and 22, that again, it's the motivation that makes something clean or unclean. And at the end of verse 19, in saying this, Jesus declared, all foods are fit to be eaten. That was a very, very sweeping statement to put in parentheses, because it really totally changes the attitude toward dietary restrictions that had been a characteristic of the Jewish mission in the Gentile world. Okay, so the disciples are learning things faster than they can comprehend. Let's look at one other section. 8:17-18. Jesus now has fed the 4,000, has refused to give a sign to the Pharisees, has warned the disciples. Well, we can look at 8:14. Now, what are disciples for, huh? They ought to be a support group. They ought to be there to arrange the chairs ahead of the meeting, take the tickets, or pass among the crowd for a collection. They ought to have the money. Take care of that. They ought to have the food ready, you know, snacks at the right time, drinks out, coffee poured. Well, the folks aren't doing too well. They've forgotten to bring them. Now, this isn't for, you know, this is not to feed 4,000 people. This is for themselves. They have enough bread for the journey. They have one loaf. So, Jesus uses this opportunity to warn them against the yeast of the Pharisees and yeast of Herod, and of course they don't figure out what he's talking about. They take it personally. He says this because we don't have any bread. And Jesus then, knowing what they're saying, says, and notice this, why are you discussing about not having any bread? Don't you know or understand yet? Are your minds so dull? You have eyes, can't you see? You have ears, can't you hear? Remember, the two miracles that end these two sections are a miracle of making the deaf hear, and we are just about to see a miracle of making the blind see. Jesus says, don't you remember? And then he asks them carefully, do you remember how much was left over of the little bit you had when I used my power through you? Well, yes, there were 12 baskets left, and then 7. He goes through the litany here to get sure that they understand what happened, which they do, but they don't understand what that has to say about the power of Jesus. So then we end this double section this with the blind man's healing. And it's an interesting little story. It just follows there, 22 to 26, four verses. Like the earlier deaf mute, which we haven't looked at, it's people that bring him. They beg Jesus to touch him. Jesus does so, uses spittle in both cases. But in this case, there is a two-stage healing. Jesus asks the man, "Can you see anything?" in verse 23, and the man looks up and says, "Yeah, but people look like trees walking around." It's not a bad image for coming out of the doctor's office with your eyes dilated, huh? And all that stuff they put in. Well, he's on the way, but he's not quite there. And it's interesting, that's about where the disciples are in this section. They know a little, but not enough. And so Jesus again places his hands in the man's eyes, then his eyesight returns, and once again there is the warning about spreading the word. Still keep it quiet. Okay, so these three chapters then, we've looked at very summarily, and I invite you to go back, but we are doing this just to see that Jesus begins now to concentrate on teaching and working with the disciples, and that they are not terribly able to cope with all this new information. Now, it's great fun to kid about the disciples, and I sort of like to do it. I'm sure everybody does. But I don't think Mark's intention is to make them appear as dolts or complete idiots. But remember, Mark is writing to an early group of Christians who also were having trouble coping and understanding with what Jesus as the Messiah meant. They believed, but there were lots of problems. And that's never gone away. So maybe we can, instead of, you know, just seeing the disciples as dumb, we can see them as a lot like all of us, who, you ask somebody to be, you know, to go out and talk about their faith, their first answer will be usually, "Well, I don't know enough, or I'm not too sure. I'd like to have let's have an instruction class. Let's learn about how to do this." We're all feeling a bit unprepared and a bit inadequate. And I think this whole section simply is to say, that's not new. Whenever one confronts the mystery of the Christ, human understanding is baffled. And even the people who were with him at the time could not fully grasp and understand what's going on. But now the scene begins to change. We come to this climactic verse or section, 8:27 and following, when Jesus and his disciples come to a village or villages north of the Sea of Galilee, quite far north in Palestine. And he asks them this question, "Who do people say that I am?" It's a familiar passage. But now we know so much about the rest of Mark, I hope it will have some new flavor to you. First of all, the answer that they give him in verse 28 is essentially the answer that Herod was toying with. Is he John the Baptist, or is he Elijah? That was the, in chapter 6, the issue with Herod. Who is this person? Is it Elijah? No, he said it's John the Baptist come back. And then the option of one of the prophets is added. What about you, though? Who do you say that I am? And it's Peter who speaks up and says, "You are the Messiah." First time that word has occurred in Mark since the title, since verse 1. The good news about Jesus, Messiah, the Son of God. First time it's used. You are the Christ. And Jesus' first answer is exactly what he said to the demons, for they confessed who he was. Do not tell anyone. Now again, we come to that question, why? Well, maybe the why will be clearer to us as we look at now at the subsequent events following this insight, I call it at this point. It's kind of a glimpse, an insight. From here on, Jesus begins to talk to his disciples about what Christ means, what Messiah means. There are at least four mentions of his suffering that occur in these next chapters. We're going to look at three of them today. In fact, what I'm going to suggest we do is see that the pattern Jesus uses, or at least the pattern Mark develops here, is a kind of triple triple whammy. I'm calling this bracing for the end, because Jesus is now getting his disciples ready for what he's going to go through and what they will have to go through. Up to this time, it's been a kind of public ministry. Now, after this confession of Peter, the whole scene changes and Jesus works with the disciples, but occasionally you will hear him addressing the crowd. It will say, the crowd gathered, and Jesus said to the crowd. It's like he's sort of talking over the disciples to the rest of the church, to the first century church and everybody else. But even when he talks to the disciples, obviously it's a message for the church as well. Now, in each case, the pattern goes this way. There are three sort of stages. Jesus tells of suffering. He does it in 8:31, in 9:9, and in 9:30 and 31. And again, tomorrow. There's a fourth one. In each case, the disciples are baffled. Can't figure out what's going on. 32, 33, 9, 10, 9, 32. Mark carefully mentions the fact that the disciples do not understand. And then in each case, there is a teaching section, which is more extended. Sorry about this, I can break that up. to 29, 9:33 to 50. In each case, following exactly on the prediction, the bafflement, and then the description. Now, in some cases, there are events that are related to these. What I'm going to suggest that we do is find some congenial people around you, and we'll talk about, we'll sort of split these up, and ask you to read through these sections on discipleship. And remember now that they are questions that, well, let's put it this way. Let's look at them as helpful to the early church. If these are teachings on discipleship that Mark wanted to preserve, they obviously were teachings that would have some value for people who were attempting now to live out the Christian life in a hostile environment. So we must see these teachings on discipleship not as simply messages to the disciples, but as essentially helpful information for an early church that was struggling to understand what it was to be the messianic community in a world that wasn't really receptive to that. So we have three sections, and they're not short, either of them. They involve 10, 15, 20 verses. And I'm just going to suggest that maybe we ask the people upstairs and this group here to consider 8:34 to 9:1. And you folks in the middle section there, and maybe over a ways here, look at 9:11 to 29. And this wing, look at 9:33 to 50. I'm suggesting this time we're going to take more time. You can read it by yourself if you want to, then turn and talk to some others about it. The question we're asking is, how would this teaching on discipleship be helpful in the early church? Okay. We'll take 15 minutes or so to let you talk it over. You were getting you more involved as disciples now on the way. Thank you.
Forbid him not, for there is no man which shall do a miracle in my name that can light and speak the whole world.
He says here, he comes into the hospital, as if he didn't know. But they were silent for on the way they were discussing.
So then he takes a little child and he sat down. This was there. Yes. Didn't know if it was going to extend into the 20th century.
I don't think they ever said that they were going to They were just tagging along.
Yeah, and they probably thought, well, it's only them that were getting
companionship.
Even back here,
he's
about not, you know, that old little wreck. Don't you understand?
called?
Yeah.
Sodium chloride.
What is it? At 5,000. I love this.
Yeah, that's true.
Choice about cups of water.
Yeah.
Or who sort of gives it a cup of water to be in my name? Because you belong to Christ, verily I thank you, you shall not be But it says, because you do it in my name.
Oh, yes, you did. Yes, it's compassion for people.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is.
We didn't send you off with that.
And you will be one of the first ones to say,
then you'll have.
Well, didn't you do this and just. Oh, I didn't remember I did that. Well, I didn't do that.
Season.
You did that for me. I didn't know.
No, I didn't.
Well, my name, because you belong to Christ.
Food is good.
Mm-hmm.
Season.
Yeah.
And then it says here, best ancient authorities, they leave off these verses by cutting off your foot and carrying it away. And God wants you not to do that. It says here, verses 44 and 46.
But what does it mean? Whether worm dot or fire, I don't understand.
Is that 48? That's the word, Dorothy.
Here's I don't know the meaning.
Well,
they're the worms. They're the worms that eat them never die, and the fire that burns them is never put out.
What's that?
They're the worms that eat them. Never die, and the fire that burns them is never put out. Everyone will be purified by fire as a sacrifice is purified by salt.
When they're warm, eating diet.
In some manuscripts add verse 46. They're the worms that eat them never die, and the fire that burns them is never put out.
I don't know what that means.
The
human body is never
conceived. You are never conceived.
Just stay in hell. You're born of a virgin.
They're the ones that will never die. I think what he's
saying is
so when you are you'll be suffering in hell.
Why was it?
Okay, let's I'd like to talk about this first series first, and then we'll do the other two second. I just wanted you to know that I didn't have to divide people in four every time. Reasonably flexible.
3 points.
Okay, this first section now, as you folks over here, is Peter has declared Jesus to be the Christ. Then Jesus speaks about his suffering, and in 8:31, Peter rebukes him, and then Jesus rebukes Peter, says, "Get thee behind me, Satan." And then comes this teaching on greatness, teaching. Now, the area I've put down here is take up cross. That's kind of tried to summarize it for everybody else, because they don't know what you've been reading about. But what is that section on? How does that relate then to what the early church might have been facing or dealing with? What is it communicating to them?
They are looking for a panacea, they're not going to find it.
Right. Any other comments on that? Any other? Obviously, it's not going to be as easy as they thought it might be.
They're facing persecution from Rome, and so they're maybe being told, yes, you are being persecuted, but you have to put that behind you and focus in on God.
Okay, that's a good reminder that for them too, it was a matter often of life and death, just as it was with Jesus. So the cross is not just symbolic. And the idea is there may be something worse than death for a Christian. Death is not the ultimate disaster. Anything else you can pick out of that section? Or any other dimensions of that focus? You were fortunate, you had the most focused material.
It gave them some hope in the midst of their suffering.
Why would you say that? Why would there be hope? If you tell somebody, take up your cross and follow me.
Well, the first verse of chapter 9, there are some sinners who will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God come in power. That's hope.
Right.
That's victory. They may not understand it or realize it.
Okay, and let's go back then and remember the parables that we talked about, the parable of the seed growing, and all of those other early ones. The disciples were going to see the kingdom of God's power. It wasn't only going to be suffering. There would be power as well. And in fact, what happens next? Anybody read 9:2?
Transfiguration.
Transfiguration is the next event, which is certainly one of significance. Before we move to that, is there anybody else have a comment or an insight you'd like to share?
Well, if this was the early church, how would they understand what Jesus was saying and take up your cross? We look back and understand about the cross, but what would they see?
You mean the disciples personally?
Before the crucifixion.
Yeah.
They're
pretty baffled by all this. They really don't quite understand, because certainly the concept of cross was not a part of the teaching about the Messiah. And you've hit on, of course, the exact problem that Jesus had to deal with the disciples. It was one of those questions that we raised at the beginning. Remember, if Jesus is the long-awaited Messiah, how could he be killed by anybody? That whole concept of cross, and remember, for us again, cross is something that we come to accept. For them, it would be worse than the electric chair to talk about the Messiah dying such a terrible death. So, and this question, why do his disciples still have to suffer? That's just what the other responses were saying. Indeed, it's part of being a disciple of Messiah. You are going to have a cross. So, it was pretty baffling to him. Yes.
It was Roman custom in that time, I believe, that people that were going to be crucified would take their cross through the streets, and they'd probably seen that before and could understand what was meant by that through other experiences, other crucifixions that they've witnessed, possibly.
Absolutely, they would know what it meant to talk about crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
they wouldn't have that vividly in mind. I was taking the earlier comment to mean, how would they, could they believe that the Messiah would have to suffer that kind of death?
Mm-hmm.
They not yet know that. But it's a good point indeed. They have a very vivid idea. And so when Jesus take up their cross, you're sort of underlining the fact that we do know, we kind of accept the cross as the Christian symbol. For them, it was a very horrible, scary, nasty thing. You wouldn't want to be associated with crucified people. It's the worst kind of thing. Yes,
the bad. But the prediction in the Old Testament was that he would suffer in Isaiah, if they had that.
Yes. It's one thing, obviously, though, that they probably didn't understand the intensity of suffering, because it's one thing to say about a suffering servant, it's another to say you're going to die like a despised criminal. Yes, you.
Is Mark under the impression that the kingdom of God is coming very soon? Mm-hmm. So that verse 9:1 has to be seen in that light, too.
Yes, but what he means by the kingdom coming in power, there's a big argument. Does he mean, indeed, the coming of Christ in the last times? Does he mean the power beginning to be known, the transfiguration as a sign of that power, the resurrection? Mm-hmm. What does he mean by that coming in power? He obviously is sure that there's going to be soon, but he was also writing a number of years after Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. So, I'm not just sure whether he's thinking that the end time will come or that the kingdom, it has come in power.
Isn't he talking about the power of the Holy Spirit?
Maybe. Not clear. No one really knows, because that's all we know is what it says here, kingdom come in power. We've interpreted that in many ways later on in the church. One of them, obviously, is that it would be the second coming.
Isn't it generally understood that the disciples thought that the judgment day would come while they were still living? Generally understood.
Yeah.
And probably
Paul
that's what
also thought
yeah.
that, you know, yeah.
Paul, that's probably what this means.
Could well be. I'm suggesting, though, we shouldn't put all our money in the second coming basket, all our eggs in that basket. We also could think that there were signs of the power of the coming of the kingdom already in the ministry of Jesus, the transfiguration, the resurrection itself, and the coming of the Holy Spirit. We're going to have to move to the next group. We're going to get anywhere. Okay? You told me already that 9:1 looks ahead, and I have tried to write on this thing that transfiguration then occurs right before 9:9. Transfiguration, then Jesus predicts again that the Messiah will suffer, the disciples are again baffled, and now we have a couple of events here. And how do you interpret this business about the discussion about whether Elijah has come, and then about the casting out of the demon, as related to the life of the early church? Got any suggestions on that? Yes?
Well, like you mentioned before, if this book is indeed written to early Christians who are living within a Jewish context, then obviously the whole process of Elijah is very important to them, because they're constantly being questioned as to, well, why didn't Elijah come? Because he's supposed to hallmark the coming of the Messiah. So one of the things that are said here is that he has already come. I think the written has been fulfilled document.
So that question can be answered.
Yeah, that no longer is a big question. Right?
It's not an issue. If you understand John the Baptist as Messiah, as Elijah, then indeed that has been fulfilled. Now, and just remember, at the beginning of the book of Mark, in chapter 1, we had the baptism of Jesus. Well, we had the Elijah image, John the Baptist dressed as Elijah, coming, preaching Elijah's message, and the baptism of Jesus, in which the voice from the cloud says, "You are my son." In the transfiguration, there is a voice from the cloud that says to the disciples, "This is my beloved son." And now, immediately following that revelation to the disciples, is the discussion of Elijah again. So that we pick up those identity marks from chapter 1, that there is a forerunner, that Elijah has come back, and two, that Jesus is indeed now God's pulled on the Son. That voice comes now not to Jesus, but to the disciples.
Even more than that, on the Transfiguration Mountain, who was up there but Elijah himself?
Right? That's right. So that figure again has appeared, and that issue has been dealt with. Yes, sir.
Could you give us a few words about Elijah, his origin and his importance?
Well, Elijah was probably the most dramatic prophet of the Old Testament, although Moses was also often called a prophet. Mendelssohn has a marvelous oratorio, Elijah, which does helps a lot get all the major Elijah stories in one mind. And just to recall to you, Elijah is the one who fights very strongly against Ahab, and the king of Israel, against idolatry. Elijah raises a widow's son. Elijah is fed in the wilderness by ravens. Elijah is desolate because he has this big fight with the priests of Baal, Mount Carmel, calls down fire from heaven on the altar and proves that God of Israel is the true God. And ultimately is desolate because nobody listens to him and so on. And he goes off into this cave, and then there's this wind and fire, and finally the still small voice that speaks to him. And then at the end of his life, he is taken up into heaven. He does not die. He is taken up into heaven, giving his mantle first to his successor, Elisha. Elijah then is taken into heaven. So he has potential for coming back because he didn't die. He is a very powerful figure in the Old Testament, and because of this miraculous way of ascending to God, it was assumed that Elijah could still come back.
Perhaps we can envisage.
Thank you. It's good to have a voice from heaven.
See the fiery chariot.
Come in, Paul. Come in, Paul, wherever you are.
But we can kind of almost put ourselves in the place of those early Christians by being a guest of Jewish sisters and brothers today as they celebrate the Passover, because part of the Passover is sending a child out to the outside door to see whether Elijah has come. I mean, obviously the Jews are still waiting for the Messiah, but the sign of the Messiah will be when the child runs back and says, Mommy, Daddy, Elijah's there today. And then they have the cup in the setting waiting for Elijah, and he will then take his place, and of course then they're ready on that Passover for the Messiah's coming. That's kind of that expectation that the Christians experienced in all of this attention to John the Baptist as Elijah would come, I would suspect.
That would help then explain this issue here about whether Elijah had shown up yet or not, because it was a part of, a very vivid part of it.
Are Elijah and Elisha and Elias all three one the same?
No. Paul Elias is Elijah.
Right.
That's
right.
Just a different spelling. And Elisha is second generation. He is the successor of Elijah. But Elias is used, I guess the vulgate probably is where that comes from. But Elias and Elijah are identical. It's just a different spelling. Yes?
Moses was buried. He died and was buried. And yet we're taught that when we die, we sleep until Jesus comes. So, but personally, I don't really feel that. I feel like our spirits are with the Lord the minute we die. But in our Lutheran teaching, at least sometimes, maybe not everybody teaches that way. That when you're dead, you're asleep until Jesus comes. The resurrection of the dead.
You started with Moses. Was there what?
Well, how was Moses able to be at the transfiguration if he was sleeping in death?
Oh, okay. Well, the easy answer to that question is that the Bible does not speak with one voice on the state of the dead. There are images of sleep. There are passages that indicate that. There are passages like this that indicate that the dead Moses. Returns, it appears. There are passages that say we are with the Lord immediately. So that's the problem. Christians argue a lot about that issue because it just depends on where you start in the Bible. And that's not just because the Bible is confused, but also because the Bible is written over a very long period of time. And there are different
And then the today you will be with me in paradise.
Yeah, that's right. That's the word from the cross. That's what Jesus says to the thief. And then Jesus also tells a story about this beggar being in Abraham's bosom. Well, how does that relate to you shall be with me in paradise? It's not the same place. Well, we tend to say yes, but you could be literal and say, we have assurance that God takes care of us, but we don't quite know who's getting it. Okay, that's Elijah. Now, exorcism. I got a little boy. Here's the toughest. Why this long business about them trying to throw out a demon? The demon doesn't. Well, I say they.
The disciples trying to get rid of the demon. They can't.
They can't do it. So who has to do it?
Jesus.
Jesus comes, does it. Now, a couple little things there. This story has an interesting comment by the father of the boy. It's a story that talks about faith. We're getting more now into stories in which the faith of the individual is stressed. The father, what is the father's attitude there?
I do make so
high. Okay, that's verse 24.
Before that, he says, if you can do it, you should help us.
Yes. We are in this middle stage, aren't we? We are in the half-blind, half-seeing stage. His father is kind of like that blind man who could see a little but not well. That's where we are in the book of Mark. The disciples are beginning to see some things clearly. Their faith is not full. It is still partial. This man reflects a stage at which most of us can identify. In fact, that's probably the most famous and helpful verse to college students that I've ever come across, because they understand very well that feeling. Okay, it's an issue. How does that relate to the early church? That's the story, that they're trying to throw out a demon, the disciples can't do it, Jesus has to come and do it. How does that reflect the life of the early church?
Preachers. They are especially talking about the fact that possibly the disciples didn't have the power over this demon because of the unbelief of either the disciples or the family of the child, and that in doing so they needed prayer to pull their belief together to use that as a power.
You think it would have been common in the early church to want to cast out demons and not be able to? Or if not common, would it occur?
Well, give it a try.
They were told to do this. They were told to cast out demons. That was one of Jesus' commissions. Jesus did it. The early church probably continued to do it. It probably didn't always work. And so the issue came up, why doesn't it always work? And this is a story that says, well, it doesn't. Sometimes it takes prayer, and maybe the issue of faith then is involved, and not enough faith, it's not going to happen. So it helps explain that. Well, I heard the ding dong, and I think it would be really good for you all to come back tomorrow and we'll start. I want to be fair to you, and I think we can do that very well, because there is another passion prediction in the material for tomorrow, and it'll help us pick up where we are. So let's do that. And see you mañana.
What did you got for coffee? Have you done time to schedule?
I'm going to go to the door.
When I was passing myself.
I'm looking at the other.